All right, here's the internet portion. This is the bonus.
Okay.
Let's talk about the study.
Well, as I mentioned in our other segment, that we've seen a decline in civility and discourse in our society over the last 30 to 40 years, and scholars and college professors have been looking at this in terms of trying to understand why this is happening and documenting trends and looking at possible cause and effects. And that's been a big part of my research over the last, 10 to 15 years.
So what conclusions have you come to, or is it still pretty open?
It's still pretty open. I think it's a complex issue, and I think there's multiple causes, and I think I can only provide, one part of the picture.
Mm-hmm.
And one study that I'm recently, in the final stages of wrapping up, has been looking at discourse trends in politics, specifically the growth of apocalyptic, kinds of discourse. The idea being that the world is at a crisis point. There are threats to our existence, and we're mobilizing people with much more dramatic rhetoric than we used to. And so I'm trying to understand why is this, increasing? Why are we using this doomsday rhetoric? And so we've come up with some interesting ideas about why this is happening.
Do you think it's something generational? Is it, because when you look at revolutions, a lot of it has to do with demographics usually. Is there something that's a through line?
Well, it's definitely something we've seen over time. And it's something that I think we can note generational differences, that I think it's much more of the norm now than perhaps it was, 30 to 40 years ago. Even though I have to concede that some of the rhetoric we're talking about has been around for a long time. It's just how it's being applied and the context in which it's being applied, I think, has changed.
Well, and I every once in a while you see the research that backs up how affected the generation that survived the Great Depression were, and how strong and sturdy and almost the opposite of soft they would allow themselves to be, and it shaped that next generation.
Yeah.
But when you hear about the crisis points of this country, and this is me talking about things I never experienced and I don't know about, but the Bay of Pigs often comes up. And that seems to be like a point when your generation and generations a little older than you really got faced with, like, oh, there could be larger consequences.
No, I think you're absolutely right that we have certain, rhetorical precedents that are set that establishes a new norm.
Right.
And then we kind of go from there.
Yeah, I think, this is just kind of a live conversation. I feel like that's where I see that beginning, because I'm living in the boomer generation's world right now.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, I'm quite a bit older than you, and so I have a wider frame of analysis. And I have to tell you, politics hasn't always been this way. We haven't had all this, dire doomsday rhetoric that we've seen in recent years. And so the question is, why has rhetoric gotten so dark? What can explain, this sort of increased, kind of darkening, of rhetorical appeal? And I think we can actually draw a line, and this is somewhat speculative on my part, but we saw one type of discourse that was very common in religious rhetoric, the sort of end times, and you have to get your affairs in order, to avoid dire consequences. And that's been, part of mainstream, religion for a long time.
Well, and I feel like I grew up at the 59th minute of it for a little bit.
Yeah.
Right there in the 90s, I feel like they were ready.
Well, that was just one scenario. The idea that the year 2000 represented a milestone, and and that potentially represented the end of times and so on. This is something that bubbles up from time to time. But I think it's much more pervasive now in terms of just everyday discourse. And so if we look at, election discourse, if you and I were running, for office, 30, 40, 50 years ago, I would say, well, vote for Scott over Barlow because I'm more qualified, or my stances on the issues are perhaps better than your position. But today, it's much more likely, I would say, Barlow is the focus of evil in the modern world, and he has to be stopped at all costs because it will represent an end to our way of life if he succeeds, and so on. And it creates such incredible, polarization that it makes governing after the election very difficult, because you can't work with people when you frame them that way.
Well, it's very hard to place blame in that scenario, though, because you've got people that are being steered by rhetoric that you'd hope they would have the wherewithal not to be steered by that and actually care about the quality of the candidate and their stance on some issues. So, I mean, if say I'm leading a completely moral party, we're not going to do that. I'm going to lose to a party that's going to play on the emotional feelings of the public, or do I need to dive down and play on the feelings too in order to have the greatest outcome?
Well, I think this parallels other trends that we've seen, that we've seen a decline in locally owned media, and as such, we see more of a nationalized media focusing on national political figures, which is actually a separate research project I'm working on. And in the absence of that kind of information, the public has to queue off something in terms of, you know, voting one person over another.
Mm-hmm.
And in the absence of perhaps more issue-based information, then people are going to make it more of a personality-based decision. And I think this is where this doomsday rhetoric comes in, that we personify people as being evil. I also think this overlaps with the rise of political engagement of certain religious groups, mm-hmm. you know, in politics.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw the rise of the so-called new right.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that evangelicals became more active in our political process.
The formerly silent majority.
Yes, but they're very vocal now.
Mm-hmm.
And they've taken a model of rhetoric that was once, you know, very mainstream in religion. It still is. And now they're applying in politics. And I think what was once perhaps appropriate, mm-hmm. you know, and perhaps in a religious context, perhaps may be less than appropriate, perhaps used in a political context. So rather than talking about metaphysical evil,
mm-hmm.
we now personify that evil as represented by opponents politically.
Right. And off mic, we talked about this isn't the first time this has happened.
No, not the first time, but I do think it represents a fairly recent trend in our politics, which I think represents a threat to cohesion in our politics.
I guess I'm asking, what is the tool we have available to curb this behavior, and what's the
I think that's the real challenge. Now, if we look at positive change in our society, I think it first starts with awareness. And I think that's where scholars kind of come into play, that we document trends.
Mm-hmm.
And then after we document the trends, we document the significance of those trends in terms of how they impact us. And once our sensitivity is increased, then we can make more conscious choices.
Right.
Because we understand the trade-offs associated with that. So, for instance, years ago, we had a lot of sexist terminology in our discourse. So we had the chairman of the board. Now we just call it, you know, the chief executive officer.
Right.
You know, one small step for man, a giant leap for mankind, you know, that would be phrased differently today.
Right.
And part of that was just raising our awareness of the insidious effects that sexist language has in terms of how we see one another.
So do we, I mean, but languages are complicated, and we've got entire languages that are purely gendered. What do you do with that?
Well, like I said, I think you increase our sensitivity, and then we make more conscious rhetorical choices. And so today, there are certain types of language forms that we avoid because we understand the negative implications of it. So I think if we agree that certain forms of rhetoric are inappropriate in certain contexts, then we can choose to go in another direction.
I could hear that. I also think some people make a side argument out of making words into trouble. If sub is bad, sub versus super, I'm describing the position of something within a framework. It's not.
No, I think you point to an excellent, dilemma, you know, in the sense that if people have incentive to engage in perhaps unethical rhetoric for personal gain, they'll do so.
So here's a good one. Name, people being secure on their names is really important. Somebody could be named Maria in a Hispanic household, and they want that R role. They want to be, but maybe I wasn't raised in a household that had a lot of role R's. I don't have that muscle memory. I can't do it. I think I came to the conclusion years later, looking at world history, it turns out at one point a guy from Germany got put in charge of England, and they said, hey, buddy, they don't do that V thing that much. You're going to be William now.
Yeah.
You're not Wilhelm anymore. That the name, it how much you want – I mean, there's a whole era of French exploration and Spanish exploration within this continent where they all kind of had like three or four different names depending on who they were talking to.
No, but that very observation I think gives us hope. You point to the fact that language does evolve mm-hmm. and norms do evolve. And so I think if we can increase our awareness, and the idea being that if we understand that if I engage in this form of rhetoric, even though it might be beneficial to me over the short term,
mm-hmm.
there are long-term consequences. And I think ethics, by their very nature, are constraining, that sometimes we have to sacrifice self-interest to the greater good. And so there are certain types of language choices that mm-hmm. I should engage in because it's detrimental to the interests of others.
Right. And I think we talked about language and spaces where they're appropriate. And I think what I'm getting at is there isn't an answer. I don't think there is an answer. The answer is to be flexible and to keep changing. Because the word that protects a group that's limited and small today – could be the word that builds them up and keeps them on top of people tomorrow. So you have to keep evolving with that. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I think, you know, the first step along this journey is to make what was covert more overt. And then we make more conscious choices in terms. And then we can have a debate about that, you know, in terms of is a particular term empowering or is it detrimental? But at least we should make informed choices. And I think that's where research, you know, by the academic community can play a role in terms of documenting trends, helping us understand the consequences of those trends.
Right.
And then we could perhaps make more informed choices.
All right. Well, is there anything else you want to dive in on the research?
Well, what I discovered was is that, you know, this sort of doomsday apocalyptic, you know, kinds of rhetorical forms has increased by over 100%.
Wow.
During the study period. We looked at it from 1980 to 2024. And so we saw a dramatic increase, you know, in this dark rhetoric. And I think it does have detrimental impact in terms of our political system, because when we use this kind of context or this kind of, tactic to mobilize people, then I think it makes politics much more of a destructive, you know, process.
Sure. Is there a potential for it to turn the other way and just make people lethargic? Because you can't keep telling me that I'm going to be grounded forever and then I'm not. I'm going to kill you, kid, and then I'm not. I'm fine. I'm more worried
about the opposite. Though I think, you know, when you start using such dramatic appeals, then after a while they become less effective. Then you have to make it even more dramatic.
Well, I'm thinking maybe the dramatic is playing on those that are staying involved, and then we've got a terrible voter turnout. So it's the other ones are just like, oh, you mean, forgive me, but Trump's going to destroy us as a president. I just saw it 4 years ago.
Yeah.
It's hard for people to, you can't tell me it's the end of the world when I've lived through it before.
No, I think there's limits to this kind of appeal, but unfortunately, it hasn't started tapering off yet.
I think the limit is its strength though. Cause if you're just trying to divide and conquer, having some people check out and having some people freaked out and not having them be able to communicate to each other about the actual level of concern they should have, which is somewhere in between.
Brendan, you're a dangerous man. I think that's an interesting angle that I hadn't really considered.
Well, we can talk about it all the time. And look for new episodes. We're just kidding. But thank you for tuning into the online portion and hearing about some of David's research. Right. And look for him in town. It's Tahlequah. It's small. This is Lakes Country 102.1.